peace talks. After several months of one-on-one meetings with over 200 Syrian stakeholders, DiMistura said there remains, quote, no consensus on the way forward. And he noted with dismay that terrorism concerns, fueled by the rise of the Islamic State, are intensifying the four-and-a-half-year Syrian war. Noting that the UN is obliged to keep the cause of peace alive, DiMistura called for future negotiations to break down into four thematic fields, in the hopes of locating more narrow areas of agreement. For more global news headlines, visit talkradionews.com.
This is X-Ray FM. Our mission is to put a microphone to the best and most distinctive of Portland, to build a culturally relevant center for ideas, music, and creativity in service of a more open media and a more just community. X-Ray FM is an independent, non-commercial radio station. We broadcast at 107.1 FM and 91.1 FM and stream online at xray.fm from our studios in the Falcon Art community. X-Ray FM, radio is yours.
Support for X-Ray FM comes from Dante's. On Tuesday, June 16th, Dante's will be hosting the Super Suckers. More information and tickets online at dantesLive.com.
And I know what time it is.
You're listening to KXRY Portland at 107.1 FM, 91.1 FM, and streaming online everywhere at xray.fm. Welcome to the Five Quadrants of Portland. I'm your host today, Jen Chavez. Today, I think I can say our theme is debt, literally and figuratively. Debt and how closely it can follow you around. Debt and how it can haunt you even as or after you pay it. Debt and how it changes lives. Are you in debt? I'm in debt. Debt feels like a universal American experience these days. In the second half, we'll look at the so-called debt to society that people speak of when they refer to incarceration. The prisons tell us that prison is about rehabilitation, right? That when you leave, your debt is paid, so to speak. Well, people with criminal backgrounds who are ready for their new life and their second chance are finding that not to be so when they're looking for employment after serving time. In the wake of local and statewide labor reforms banning questions about criminal backgrounds on job applications, one local business, Dave's Killer Bread, is taking its longtime commitment to hiring formerly incarcerated people to the next level with the launch of a new foundation. We'll hear more from the foundation's executive director, Genevieve Martin, around 12:30, so stay tuned for that. But first, that sweet, sweet student loan debt. I personally currently owe the federal government around $20,000 for the education I completed 9 years ago, and that's after paying it off every month for nearly a decade. It eats up a larger portion of my monthly income than I am comfortable with. It's hard to make it work sometimes, heck, often. And I am not unique. If anything, I am lucky. When I talk to my peers, I hear $70,000, $80,000, $100,000. And I am 31, so keep in mind that this is 2005 tuition. We've been through a decade of tuition hikes and cuts to education funding since then. And God forbid you go to graduate school. The days of flipping burgers on the weekends to put yourself through school, as baby boomers sometimes like to brag about, are behind us. Student debt in the U.S. has ballooned to $1.2 trillion, surpassing credit card debt. MarketWatch recently reported that the class of 2015 has the most debt in U.S. history. People call it a crisis, one that spans from the individual student trying to find work after graduation to the entire national economy. And it's made worse by colleges that engage in predatory lending practices and coerce their students into high-risk loans, and worse. One such college chain, the for-profit network Corinthian Colleges, engaged in misconduct so egregious that they were investigated and sued by the government, eventually declaring bankruptcy and shutting down in April of this year. Well, some of its former students launched an unprecedented student debt strike, refusing to pay back loans they contend were unethical and furthermore illegal. What started as the Corinthian 15 is now a nationwide movement around student debt resistance, taken up by the National Occupy Offshoot Strike Debt and embodied in the National Debt Collective. And Portland, not a city to sleep on social justice issues, of course, has a local chapter. I'm joined in the studio now by Daniel Hong, who is a student organizer with Strike Debt Portland and a junior of political science at Reed University. Daniel, thanks so much for joining me. Welcome to the Five Quadrants of Portland.
Thank you. Just to clarify, it's Reed College, not Reed University.
I apologize okay. To Reed students, present and former Reed College. Well, thank you and welcome to the show, Daniel. I want to start by asking you about the formation of the larger student debt strike movement I just mentioned. Debt striking picked up earlier this year with the actions of the Corinthian 15, which turned into the Corinthian 100 and then into the Corinthian Collective. The names refer to the now shuttered chain of for-profit colleges nationwide. Many would recognize Heald or Everest, two college chains owned by Corinthian from television commercials, advertising a quick and affordable way into a new career. But former students say they were defrauded and swindled. Can you tell us what are the practices in question of which Corinthian has been accused?
Right. So, The National Strike Debt Movement and many of the organizers have found collected investigations and lawsuits against Corinthian spanning back in 2010. So there's been over 5 years of documented report of just systemic predatory abuse, predatory lending, of both on the federal level of the college taking out loans on the students' names without their consent, misusing government funding and loans loans away from education and into shareholders' profits. Having deceptive job placement stats that they would tout, you know, in their commercials saying, everybody can get a job in medical coding in 9 months. Get your degree in 9 months and we'll guarantee you have a job. Jobs weren't guaranteed.
Right.
They were lying. And the Corinthian colleges had their own private loan subsidiary called Genesis Loans that they contracted with, and these loans were twice or more of the interest rates of federal student loans, and that these loans are required students to pay back as they were attending college.
Oh,
not six, not 6 or 9 months after they receive their degree, which are typically for federal student loans. So these students not only were taking out debt, they were required to pay them back and thus find whatever work they can as they were studying school, when they should direct all of their attention and pursuing their degree rather than finding the money to pay for it. Otherwise, why would they go to school?
Right.
Themselves burnt out on both. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, I've read testimonials by former Heald or Everest students who say, you know, I got my associate's degree in like paralegal studies and I went to law firms and they laughed in my face when they saw where I had gotten my education. Like, and that speaks to the misleading job placement information.
Absolutely. And also just the lack of accreditation and really the lack of investment that Corinthian gave and committed to actual educative educative power and pursuit, because again, their first and last motive is profit, because that's mm-hmm. they are a for-profit school. True. So they're not going to find the best teachers. They're not going to have the best connections outside of their network.
Yeah, you know, in light of these flaws and furthermore their misconduct, a group of former Corinthian College's students launched a debt strike, refusing to repay student loans they'd incurred at those colleges. They drew attention to a rarely used provision in federal law that makes students eligible for debt relief if their college has behaved illegally. Can you tell me, how did they put pressure upon the government with their actions, and what degree of success have they had with their debt strike?
So in the FAFSA, the Free Applications for Federal Student Aid, there's a provision said called Defense to Repayment, which summarized states that if your school broke the law and violated state and federal crimes and received fines and penalties for their wrongdoing, you as an individual student who owes debt from that school has a defense to not repay. Now, straight from the Department of Education, unfortunately, the department did not have any formal process to actually hear complaints from students and have students use that clause. Only two or three cases were reported by the department before the launch of the Corinthian debt strike, and which was extremely frustrating for the striking students, because there was nobody to like listen really to them. There was no form to fill out, you know, a lot of personal information really, because a lot of loans require access to your social security number, your address, your birthday, your credit history, and so forth. And there's just no infrastructure behind the department actually working on that clause. So, and respond to that clause. So the Debt Collective actually created their own online application through their website, mm-hmm. debtcollective.org, in which they were able to collect hundreds of individual forms from individual Corinthian students making that clause. And these forms and these submitted forms were later sent to the Department of Education Secretary Arne Duncan, with a clear demand with the strikers of a class-wide unilateral cancellation of all federal student loans tied to the Corinthian College network, all of them. Because partially, the Debt Collective was showing and arguing just how tedious and difficult it was, and really re-victimizing, re-traumatizing for a lot of students to have to prove their burden, prove their abuse, proved what was done to them, you know, their financial hardship because of Corinthian, what they have done to the students. Mm-hmm. And they were calling on Arne Duncan to make a precedent and have a class-wide discharge cancellation. Unfortunately, Arne Duncan just took on the individual route, saw the application process that the Debt Collective created themselves, and announced that the department would be making their own application process for individual Corinthian students to apply for. And that was a way to divide the movement. According to the strikers, that was a way to privilege some Corinthian students over others. Corinthian students who have the time and energy, the internet access, really the education, the vocabulary, because, you know, legal forms aren't English. People don't speak in legal forms yet that the department requires.
Mm-hmm.
Requires as gritty information as possible for their defense. So the strikers are continuing to put pressure on Duck and saying, like, no, this is not justice. This is not the way the department regulates the industry.
Mm-hmm.
By putting the unfair burden on individual students. And what was really exciting for the strike, however, is on a related note, you know, Corinthian has since filed for bankruptcy, and their assets are being liquidated as we speak right now. And the federal government actually allowed a student committee led by former Corinthian students, many of them being Corinthian strikers, to oversee and actually influence the bankruptcy process. So actually the tables are turning where these Corinthian students are becoming their creditors and saying, actually, Corinthian, you owe us for an education that's voided, mm-hmm. for an education that for the most recently graduated or current students didn't even receive a degree, you know,
mm-hmm.
because of the crimes committed.
Great. Well, thank you for that update, and we'll certainly stay tuned to Corinthian. But, you know, your advocacy locally has highlighted the fact that some of these issues are not really isolated to this chain of particular colleges alone, or even to the for-profit college industry. Before getting into, you know, talking specifically about Strike.Portland, I wanted to ask what you've seen as a student at Reed, or perhaps from your own experience, that demonstrates the problems student debt can cause students at other schools, even public schools or private nonprofit colleges or universities?
Mm-hmm. So, good question. To speak on my personal experience, I expect to have at least $15,000 of student loans by the time I receive my bachelor's. And I am quite frankly privileged for that, because that's on the lower end of the scale.
Absolutely.
You know,
yeah.
And while Reed College has a history of course, wealth, but also on a history of providing more grant money than other universities, particularly public ones. Now, the many public universities receiving generations of budget cuts, mm-hmm. stemming from the 60s,
certainly.
Which then why they would be unable to provide financial aid and thus would have to rely on private finance and student loans. So, but anyways, a lot of students at Reed actually can their dependents can actually afford the entire tuition of the student. So that's another kind of form of privilege. Not, you know, Reed's tuition is $50,000-$60,000 a year, and about roughly half of the student body, their dependents can afford all of that. You know, how many? But that's definitely not the case for other students, particularly public colleges, where, gosh, I don't know how. I don't even know the stats. I don't know even how they are released, you know, or who keeps track of them. You know, I kind of want to, however, kind of bring light on really just the nuances of debt, and really, you know, on who owes what to whom and who takes action on whom, because, you know, debt without coercion, debt without punishment, you know, without people facing the consequences if they don't pay their debts. Without that, it's kind of meaningless, you know. If your debt isn't being collected on, if you're not threatened on losing something for not paying back your debt, you know, what incentive do you have to pay for it? I have a transgender friend that I won't say his name, but he had to take out a $1,700 emergency loan from the college for emergency medical procedures for him and his partner. Partner over the school year last year, and the student and the administration, the financial aid office, has given him an ultimatum to pay back $1,700 of his emergency loans by September, or that he'll be kicked out of school, that he won't be able to complete his following year and seek his completion of his degree at Reed. Now, this is a school that charges $56,000 a year, and yet they are willing to terminate a student's education for $1,700. Mm-hmm. And now it really comes to speak to show that, you know, him, much like me, much like many other students at Reed, you know, we technically owe a lot more to Reed. You know, thousands of the student loans that we assigned to the financial aid office. However, not all of these loans are necessarily to Reed. You know, some of them being directly from the federal government. And really the agreement was that that these loans wouldn't start being collected on until after we graduate, at least 6 to 9 months after we graduate. So it just kind of shows really that despite how much I owe, despite how much he and other students owe in terms of the loans that kind of are creatively called financial aid and to our college, actually it shows that debt is about power and debt is about coercion, and that it really proves to justify kind of the seizure and the loss of someone's livelihood, of someone's work, of someone's freedom by the person who lends out the money. So thankfully, my transgender friend, he raised a GoFundMe and has successfully raised over $1,700 so that he can pay back the administration. But it just really shows that really, you know, we really need to think about debt,
right.
and not all debt is equal.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, dollar amounts in this particular situation didn't matter. But
and I mean, it highlights also that, you know, I think that student debt is as viewed as an issue that's only an issue once you graduate, and to the degree that some students, I think, kind of ignore the fact that it exists and try to forget about it until they're out, but know that this is affecting current students as well.
Well, especially, you know, if life happens.
Mm-hmm.
And if, you know, if emergency people needed have family emergencies, medical emergencies, psychiatric emergencies, have to take leaves, you know, have to seek treatment, rehabilitation, and other just, you know, emergency everyday expenses that occur that students do not have the savings for,
right.
You know, and to find that really there may be a support network for you and an agreement and a terms of agreement that works around you. Say if you're on the two or four year path to school. But however, there's, you know, that just shows there's a lack of a safety net for things that arise that aren't unforeseen for you, you know. And we as Strike at Portland, we're really concerned and nuanced for that, and kind of speak about these economic alternatives that are part of our mission to demand for. Mm-hmm. Is that we really want to see really wants to see society to have a broader safety net, and really to...
For those who don't have a safety net from their parents, you know, and their individual background.
Exactly. Really kind of raising the mm-hmm. idea of a common good.
Very good. Well, thank you. If you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with Daniel Hong. He's a student organizer with Stride Debt Portland and a junior at Reed College. We have a few minutes left, but I'd love to hear about your priorities as a student organizer with Stride Debt Portland. For example, I understand that you were involved with a recent debtors assembly that pulled together students and faculty at PSU to speak about their experiences with debt. What are you focused on as a local organizer right now?
That's a really good question, because that's a question we're asking ourselves, because debt is very big, and it's all interconnected, both in our personal bank statements and really in the politics around the world. And we as Portland, we as Stride Debt Portland, we have been consistent in public education, really raising the real historical political agenda behind debt. And really raising, exposing the stigmas and the stigmas associated with debt, and just the narratives of that you are lazy, that you need to pay up, that you should be ashamed for being in debt.
Right,
and to kind of release those anxieties and fears, and really debtors' assemblies, those were a strategy and tactic that the national strike debt movement has found to be effective in public education. You know, these free public gatherings of debtors and their supporters and their allies to speak about debt frankly, candidly, how it affects them, learn about it politically, be ready and to anticipate collective action around it, and so we keep close ties with the National Debt Collective, and they're ready to launch regional organizing across all 50 states in the United States, and their intent is to raise up debtors, form unions, and build strikes against common creditors. I just kind of got off my messages last night and talked with a wonderful friend who is a student indebted to the art institutes. Mm-hmm. And, since the Corinthian strike has been launched, people from the art institutes, ITT Tech, and ITT Tech, and I'm blinking on the other one, has been joining forces and saying, hey, we're part of the same, this is the same industry. So we are being just as much exploited as you are. Let's work together. And we're really excited to just find those connections, mm-hmm. And to really be the assets and support. Because while we have a really strong core group of 7 and 8 people, none of us necessarily owe debt to any common creditor. And so while we can't launch a debt strike ourselves, we can certainly help others.
Great. Just in the last few minutes of our chat, I wanted to run by you, see what you thought of the recent bill passed by Governor Brown that offers free or so-called free community college to eligible students. Is this sort of reform a step in the right direction, or does it fall short in your estimation?
Well, it's a step in the right direction, of mm-hmm. course,
sure.
Strike Debt Portland and nationally, our beliefs are clear. We believe that education, housing, medicine, those are human rights, mm-hmm. and that everybody should deserve access to it, and everybody should be supported in receiving these services. So it's a step in the right direction that community colleges are being free, but you know, it really asks ourselves, like, to who? You know, it's for students who were, it's for students who received their diploma or their GED within the last 6 months. So it's only serving the current generation. It's not asking, okay, will we make community college free for the baby boomers, for the Gen Xers, for the millennials, you know, for everybody to receive a community college education. And also, it also asks, what about the four-year colleges, you know, where really most emphasis and really most emphasis and most pressure, honestly, by society puts on graduating seniors in high school to attend a four-year college, right, instead of a two-year university and a two-year community college. And then finally, it asks us, you know, what about debt cancellation? How is it actually really honestly that fair for the current generation, for the current born to attend a service that is now free, higher education, mm-hmm, yet have people born before them still pay back their loans to a service, you know, where it wasn't free for them? You know, mm-hmm, we really need to expand, services are free needs to be really tied to the cancellation of coercion obligation that prior generations have unfortunately been put on, you know? And so meaning that otherwise we're just privileging people who were born who were born at a right time and a right place, mm-hmm, rather than, and that's not fair.
Well, you know, thank you so much for all of your input on this. And just before we go, where can people go to find more resources and more information about what you're doing at Strike Debt Portland?
So Strike Debt Portland, you can find us on Facebook. We have a group page called Strike Debt Portland. You can also join our email list. It's a active organizers email list that with announcements on our general meeting times and our work groups and our latest projects. You can find it on Google Groups. Just search Strike Debt Portland. And I want everybody who is a debtor and who wants to know more about their individual debts they may have, whether it be credit, mortgage, student, medical, etc., to go on strikedebt.org/DROM. That's strikedebt.org/DROM. National organizers have released their second version of the Debt Resistors Operations Manual that provides excellent historical analysis, mm-hmm, and individual steps that debtors can take to assert their financial rights, particularly amongst debt collectors.
Terrific. Well, Daniel, I'm so happy you were able to come by the studio today. I've been speaking with Daniel Hong, political science student at Reed College and a student organizer with Strike Debt Portland. Daniel, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you.
Coming up next, we'll hear about the launch of a local company, Dave's Killer Bread, new foundation dedicated to providing employment opportunities for those with criminal backgrounds, from the foundation's executive director, Jean-Vieve Martin, when the Five Quadrants of Portland continues on X-Ray FM.
One, two. You understand?
Welcome back to the Five Quadrants of Portland on X-Ray FM. I remain your host, Jen Chavez. Now I want to shine a light on positive work being done by a local business around an issue we've discussed on the show before, employment barriers faced by people with criminal backgrounds. This issue has gotten much debate as communities have advocated for labor reforms banning the box or removing criminal history questions from job applications, first citywide and then statewide. Advocates of successful ban the box reforms say it goes a long way to empower formerly incarcerated people faced with economic instability and the threat of recidivism after leaving prison to find their second chance. After all, as one local nonprofit says with its very name, second chances are for everyone. Although the reforms did pass, some in the business community were, say, less hospitable to the idea and made that known, but not Dave's Killer Bread. No, the local bakery has been committed to providing employment opportunities to people with criminal backgrounds for 10 years now, with formerly incarcerated employees making up one-third of the Dave's workforce. And now, ahead of the eight ball once again, Dave's Killer Bread has launched a new foundation dedicating to expanding these employment opportunities throughout the business community. I'm joined today by Genevieve Martin, the Dave's Killer Bread's Foundation's new executive director, to learn more about the company's efforts around this issue. Genevieve, thanks very much for joining me and welcome to the Five Quadrants of Portland.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, absolutely. It's a pleasure. You know, so I want to start with the company's inspiration for its longtime commitment to hiring those with criminal backgrounds, the man himself, Dave Dahl. When I first moved here about a decade ago and picked up my first loaf, I, like many others, read his story with great interest. It's printed by the picture of smiling, mustachioed Dave playing his guitar. It struck me as very honest. How has Dave's story played a part in your commitment to these hiring practices?
It's certainly been, you know, the inspiration behind starting it at all. So when we started 10 years ago, so you probably were introduced to the product when we were still brand new and in our infancy, he was definitely that catalyst for these employment practices. And so we hired on additional folks as the brand got larger, and we found that this was something really important that should be done, and we figured out what worked, and we're very excited to be able to share that because we recognize there's Dave, there's all of our current employee partners that have backgrounds, and then there's a million more plus of these individuals that need assistance in finding employment.
Absolutely. You know, using Dave's story as a proxy for others with criminal backgrounds, we should say he was welcomed back into the business after having served time. What do you think could have happened to him if he wasn't welcomed back into the family business? I mean, if we look at the experiences of many trying to seek work after incarceration, can you speculate on the challenges he may have faced?
Sure, I could speculate all day. I mean, to kind of take a piece out of, you know, textbook type stories that you hear, because Dave is really one of many, and his story could have been one of many that we hear every day. And that is, without employment being an option that's on the table, or that is on the table, is that it's minimum wage, which we know it's very difficult to live on such a low wage, especially when you have additional costs like restitution. You know, a lot of people with criminal backgrounds also have family, so there's backlog child support and whatnot. So it's created a system that's really difficult for them to be successful. So, you know, the speculation can go that any one of these people would get a minimum wage job and struggle to make ends meet, maybe working multiple jobs, and that's very depressing for anyone, regardless of background.
Yes.
And so that is why recidivism, you know, tends to fluctuate in rather high percentages, is that they have found a much more lucrative way to provide for themselves in, you know, a not legal manner, and that's why we see that, you know, often called revolving door of recidivism.
Mm-hmm. You know, so as I mentioned, and you've discussed, one-third of Dave's Killer Bread employees have criminal backgrounds. That's over 100 people. In the past, how have you implemented this employment practice? Did you partner with social service agencies or anything like that? Or did kind of the word just get out and you started seeing more people with backgrounds applying to work there?
I would say this happened fairly organically. Word definitely got out. It's become a known thing that Dave's Killer Bread hires people with a background. And so we see people kind of flock towards job openings because they know there's an opportunity. They know that there's hope, provided there's a spot. We have been a little bit strategic at times, and that was, you know, as we've grown in the last 10 years exponentially, so that we're now in all 50 states and across Canada. So we've had to do some growth in our employee roster. So we have definitely partnered with organizations. We have one temp agency that we've used for quite a long time that has the same commitment to providing second chances for people with criminal backgrounds that we do. So it was a really natural partnership for us. We've also made sure that we are very much in lockstep with some of the local organizations that support folks with backgrounds as they reenter, and they know how to refer folks to us if they have a candidate that would really meet our job requirements.
Oh, great. Well, you know, speaking of these folks, I'd love if you could tell me a little bit about the people making up that portion of your workforce. You know, for just one example, the announcement of your foundation launch mentions the current plant manager who got hired after doing 15 years time. But I bet your employees have had diverse experiences with the criminal justice system. What can you say about their stories?
Oh, there's so many. So we can make a big generalization, and that would be many of them started with a substance abuse issue that led to other types of crime. So it's very much the types of stories you might hear in the news otherwise. So addiction begins, it's harder to get whatever the substance is that you are now addicted to due to price and demand, and you start getting creative in how you're going to go about getting those substances and continue that path. So you mentioned the one in the press release. So that is our plant manager, and he started at the bottom, entry-level position here in the ovens department, worked his way through each department because he saw a real opportunity of a place where he could promote through and have a career, and he has done exactly that, and now he leads our entire production operation, overseeing almost 200 of our employee partners. So it's very exciting, and he's one of several people that have done that here within our facility. Our production manager has done the same thing. He's risen through the ranks from the bottom up to, you know, almost the top at this point. There's really no stopping him at this point. My outreach coordinator has also a bit of a colorful past. You would never know that now because she's a completely different person than she was, you know, nearly 14 years ago when she made a couple bad choices.
Mm-hmm. You know, one common thread I found in employee testimonials from these employees is great relief, and beyond that, almost surprise. The plant manager we were talking about, Ronnie, said he'd have never thought in his wildest dreams 5 years ago today that he would be where he was. When employees are accepted for a job, do you find that they struggle with confidence? And how do people work through all the stigmas that they've had continually put on them by the rest of society as they're beginning their work with your company?
Mm-hmm. The easy answer is it's not easy.
Right.
So it's important for us as a company to be able to provide an environment or a culture, if you will, where they can figure that out, because we can't do everything for them. But what we can do is offer that supportive environment where if they're struggling with something, they know that we have an open door policy. So it could be something as small as asking, where do you keep the PTO form, but not being comfortable to kind of speak up for themselves and figure that out. So making sure that we provide that support. The beautiful thing here is that a lot of it has happened very organically, and that is the internal supports that the employee partners have created have often been on their own, just kind of accidentally. And that is, as people learn about one another and they share their experiences and their stories, they realize, oh, we've made the same poor choices and look where we are now, and they help keep one another accountable so that if someone is kind of struggling, as we all do in our lives, with, you know, I'm feeling a little down today, I just bumped into somebody that, you know, I used to associate with. It was not a good influence, and it's kind of got to me. They have a support group of their peers they can talk to who go, hey, instead of stressing about that and being worried about what you're going to do after work, let's go get coffee instead and hang out, because we know this is going to be a safe environment together.
Got it. You know, I wanted to ask particularly about mental health and whether the employees that you've hired with criminal backgrounds have struggled with mental health, how the theme of mental health is connected to the type of barriers people face when they get out. You know, Dave himself struggled with mental health, unfortunately, that made it into local press not too long ago. But it makes me want to know how do you guys as a company cope with mental health issues that may be experienced by your employees?
Sure. So that's a huge issue, right?
Right.
So it's no coincidence that you'll see that a lot of people with backgrounds struggle with some mental health issues. Again, much like the rest of the general public does from time to time. So what we've made it a point to do is we provide resources like an EAP, an employee assistance program. So in the event that somebody's struggling, they have free sessions at their disposal. They don't have to disclose it to us at all. We leave these little business cards in the bathrooms and whatnot, so it's very private. But we've also fostered an environment where they can come to their supervisor, the leadership team, human resources, and say, I'm struggling with insert X. And we do everything we can to then go find them those supports, and even to the extent of maybe sitting down and making that phone call with them. Because often that's what you need, is you just need kind of a buddy up and say, I need help, and then that person can then help make that step with them. So it being more of a medical thing, I can't say, you know, this number of people that we have employed have experienced this, but I can say what we do when we know about it.
Got it. Well, folks, if you're just tuning in, I'm here speaking with Genevieve Martin, who's the executive director of the newly launched Dave's Killer Bread Foundation. So Genevieve, let's talk about the new foundation. It was just launched yesterday. How did Dave's Killer Bread's employment practices that we've been talking about inspire the launch of this foundation?
So we had a conversation almost 2 years ago now, where we acknowledged we were employing folks with backgrounds, we were really proud of it, we were excited to see all these things that were working. And what we realized is we knew that side of it, but we didn't know the bigger picture of reentry. What does an individual experience after incarceration? They enter back into the community, then what? So we realized we needed to wrap our heads around that and understand that and be more informed, so that when we're asked all the questions we are about why do we do this, we were a little more prepared. So we hosted an event with government agencies and supportive nonprofits that work in this space to really get our footing. And what we found, and we had a theory going into this conversation of what that missing piece was. Turns out we were right, and that is there are not enough employment opportunities, which by proxy means there are not enough employers that are open to or willing to talk about accepting people with criminal backgrounds into their workforce. So what we realized is that as one of the few that really talk about it, you know, there are many that hire folks with backgrounds. They don't want to share it. They're afraid of how, you know, a stigma might be carried
sure.
over, how their consumer
yeah.
base may react. We realized we had a really special opportunity to share what we've learned. And so the foundation has been really a culmination of all these talks and all of these ideas and all these learnings, and it's built to be a collaborative effort. So with anybody already in this space, how do we collaborate with you to make truly the best practices for second chance employers and anybody interested in incorporating those into their organization?
Yeah, you know, in the launch announcement, it says that the foundation and its programming were, quote, designed with input from reentry, criminal justice, business, and human resources experts. How did input from those experts shape the foundation?
Oh, very good question. So partnering with organizations like the Department of Corrections, it's kind of a big deal. It's a huge organization, and grappling with the amount of information they have at their fingertips is a little, you know, it can be a little tricky of trying to understand that. And so being informed by the folks that are truly doing this work of, of working with the system as far as when they're placing people in incarceration and they're reentering and then they're under community supervision and what happens was so important in making sure this foundation was even worth looking at and worth launching. So if we didn't have the right connections and the right data to support the work and the theory that we had, there would have been no point. But what's been really exciting is that we've been making all these connections and we continue to make more and more, and that the network just gets larger and larger. And every single time, the idea is solidified with everyone that this is a huge need and nothing like this currently exists of that business to business, we could call it mentoring of, we've done it, we'll help you do it too.
You know, one main component of the work that you're doing has culminated in a Second Chance Summit where you've invited business, other business owners, other companies to come network with you. You know, the second summit is scheduled for this fall. What exactly happens at these summits? What are you sharing with summit attendees?
Sure. So this year, we've kind of reframed the agenda a bit. Last year was more of a discovery process and understanding the issue. This year's really more about informing and sharing what we've learned, what we know, and where we're continuing to grow. So at this year's summit, we'll have a keynote speaker of a gentleman that used to be in the House of Representatives over in Kentucky. And he actually spent a year in prison. And so he's reflected back. He will be publishing a book later this year about his experience, about the kind of history of incarceration and the growth rate that it has seen and what needs to be done about it. So he has a really great perspective that he'll be sharing. And that's Jeff Smith, who's also a professor and works in political science and policy. We'll also be working with subject matter experts from community corrections, from an insurance agency to talk about risk mitigation, which is a really key piece that's a big question that comes up from employers. Mm-hmm. We're working with the Oregon Employment Department to talk about the financial incentives that are available for employers, of which there are a couple, that are often not used simply because people don't know they exist for them. We're also talking with, other service providers that serve the individuals that are reentering so that people understand there are so many resources and services out there. The missing piece is really where do they start making a paycheck so that they can live a meaningful life and support their families and be contributing members of their community.
It's interesting that you bring up the concern that people have about hiring people with records being risky and unsafe, because that's something I have heard in recent testimonies around this issue by some business owners, business companies, and you say you want to combat that. How would you argue that employees with criminal backgrounds have played a positive role in your company, as a model for other companies to follow suit? How have they contributed to Dave's success outside of their own individual opportunity?
So that's another wonderful question. What's exciting about working with this particular part of the population is that people automatically have fears and assumptions, and one that I hear over and over is that, well, they made a bad past choice, that means they're a criminal, that means they're going to be problematic, right? And what we found is that's actually not the case. There are often times that they are less problematic than somebody without a background, and here's why. It's because they are so motivated to prove themselves, not only to you, the employer, but to their community and their families, but to themselves. Because for the first time, they have to be accountable to themselves rather than a system that's told them where to sit, when to eat, when to sleep, how to do XYZ. So they are incredibly dedicated and loyal, and we often see shining stars move up in the ranks alongside their peers without backgrounds, which is so exciting to see, and we will be sharing with more and more people. So it's really something to It's really valuable, quite honestly, because they have a little more motivation, a little more drive than, maybe hiring me off the street without a background that just kind of wants a job.
Mm-hmm. So for businesses who are interested in taking this step, who are interested in following suit, You know, you've spoken about how you've provided resources for that. I'm curious about in particular, the Second Chance Playbook that you have provided for businesses who are interested in expanding their employment opportunities. What sort of advice does that provide?
So that walks you through kind of all of the pieces and segments we have found important as we continue to grow our organization and continue to constantly improve. And so the types of things that will recognize is, first of all, you need to understand your own company and culture first before you make any big changes. You know, a lot of these are very logical steps that any company could do regardless of hiring people with or without backgrounds. So understanding that and making sure that what you have in writing or what you perceive to be your company and your culture aligns with what's actually happening on your, you know, manufacturing floor or within your office space, making sure they're connected. Then understanding exactly what your employment needs are and how you start recruiting candidates maybe in a slightly different way. Because when you hire someone with a background, they may come to you from a channel that you're not familiar with, perhaps from community corrections. So how to navigate that, what that means. Talking about some of the terminology so that you don't walk in and immediately feel like, I don't know what I'm doing here, I'm just not going to touch it. So making this way more possible and approachable. The next segments that we go through are the actual interview process. There are some really great ways you can talk about the person's background and have that really candid conversation so you feel more comfortable with them and you build that bond and that trust with them. Understanding how to assess your candidates, how to bring them on board and make sure they have the support and perhaps that buddy system that we talked about. How to talk about providing second chances so that as that piece comes up, you feel really comfortable in responding of why you're committed to that work. And then some other really key pieces is how do you continue to support the employees and yourself as the employer, of which there are many ways to do that. Understanding your risk mitigation and compliance, which sounds really heavy and tricky, but it's actually pretty straightforward. So kind of dispelling some of the myths that people might hear and feel. And understanding things like the EEOC and background checks and how to use them and what they mean. Because there's a lot of misconceptions of what various different crimes may or may not mean. And so just being more informed makes this more possible.
Great. You know, we just have a minute left, but before we go, I just want to hear, I understand there's going to be an event on August 8th. Can you give us details about that?
So that is our 10th anniversary for the brand.
Oh,
so
congratulations.
10 years ago. Thank you. So yeah, Saturday the 8th at the Portland Farmers Market, we will be kicking off our 10-year, essentially birthday party. We'll be celebrating with a bread giveaway. The city has proclaimed Second Chances Day, which is super exciting. We'll be talking about our pledge to get at least 10,000 consumers and individuals saying that they stand behind Second Chance Employment, so we can share that number with other employers and say, this is something worth doing and you have the support. It's going to be a really fantastic day.
Great. Well, where can people go to find out more info about what we're talking about the foundation, about Second Chances?
DKBFoundation.org. We'll have all the information you need and all of the information to reach out to us should they want to talk about it or ask questions or get involved. We would love to have you.
Excellent. Well, you know, Genevieve, I appreciate your time very much. Congrats on the foundation launch. I've been speaking with Genevieve Martin, the executive director of the newly launched Dave's Killer Bread Foundation. Genevieve, thanks very much for joining me today.
Thank you so much.
And folks, that about wraps it up for today's episode of the Five Quadrants of Portland on X-Ray FM. I hope it's empowered you even a little to face your debts head on and then move past them. Thanks also to my first guest, Daniel Hong of Strike Debt Portland. Thanks to my awesomely awesome producer, Jason Dennington. Thanks to you, X-Ray, for continually not 86ing me from your studios with all my wacky, nerdy ideas I'm always talking about on the mic. And thanks most of all to you, the listeners. You make radio worth making. Coming up next is Backstory, and this hour we'll be focusing on infectious diseases, so stay tuned for that. You're listening to KXRY Portland at 107.1 FM, 91.1 FM, and streaming online everywhere at xray.fm. Keep it locked, folks, on X-Ray FM, where radio is yours.